I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Imagine your city increasing its population by more than 25% overnight. A quarter more cars on the road, a quarter more students in the classrooms, a quarter more buyers and renters looking for places to live. That's the situation Baton Rouge, Louisiana faced last August as Katrina made its way to New Orleans. The city has been playing catch-up ever since. Elizabeth Thomas and Gwen Hamilton have been on the front lines of that effort, using their experience in remaking downtown Baton Rouge to make a new plan for the city. Ken Dunn is attempting to remake Chicagoans and their habits through his work on city farms, recycling, and reuse as founder and director of the Resource Center. Produce from his three farms in the heart of Chicago ends up on the tables of some of the city's best-known restaurants. Ken will tell us about his work and the lesson it holds for all cities right after this news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Plan Baton Rouge and the Baton Rouge Area Foundation are key civic players in the capital city of Louisiana. Elizabeth Boo Thomas is executive director of Plan Baton Rouge. Gwen Hamilton is senior director of Plan Baton Rouge and director of special projects for the Baton Rouge Area Foundation. Boo, Gwen, thanks for being with us on Smart City. Tell me, how is Baton Rouge different today than it was pre-Katrina?
Pre-Katrina, we were a community of about 475,000 in our county, and that's what we call a parish. And post-Katrina, we had about 600,000 people. The first 2 weeks, we maybe had an additional 100,000. But about 150,000 stayed until about November and then gradually began to move back to the New Orleans area. We were a community before Katrina that had huge transportation problems. We were victim of sprawl. We had a school system that was already under stress, and we had a wonderful economic outlook because we felt like we were growing in many ways that other communities throughout the state maybe had not had been growing. And so we were really looking at how to manage this growth.
The 125,000 additional people couldn't have helped your traffic problems, couldn't have helped your school crowding. Although the economic outlook probably got better, Gwen, how are you dealing with the sudden population increase?
Tremendous challenge. Everyone, the government, the private sector, has had to step up to the plate in a big way because we were lacking an economic development plan that we could move very quickly to implement. So we've had to kind of fast track that. Work that into the redevelopment efforts that were underway. The other issue has to do with the housing. We had a tremendous housing shortage in Baton Rouge pre-Katrina with unusually long lines for government vouchers. That has now been exacerbated, not just with the residents who were in Baton Rouge at the time of the hurricane, but now with our new residents.
Do you feel that Baton Rouge is coping about as well as any city could, given the sudden growth spurt you've had?
Yes, I really do. I think that we have adjusted transportation arteries, how they work, how they fit together. I think we have not solved the housing problem at all. You know, that is not an easy thing to solve overnight. I think every house that could be purchased was purchased within 2 weeks of Katrina. Every apartment that could be rented was rented within 1 week of Katrina. It was an amazing event to watch.
And our city was probably better postured because of Boo's great work with Plan Baton Rouge. We were a city ready to jump right into planning. We had the experience. We had the tools. So we could start immediately with planning, where some other areas that absorbed the new residents had to learn how to do planning.
Plan Baton Rouge has been underway for, what, 8 years?
8 years.
So tell me about the plan, Boo. What does Plan Baton Rouge encompass, and what do you expect it to accomplish?
The plan originally was to look at the entire parish and see how to knit the neighborhoods, the corridors, and the districts together so that it was a more cohesive community, that we would contain sprawl, that we would really focus on what were the stronger points of our city. As we looked at that back 9 years ago, it became overwhelming, and we said, you know, instead, let's start with our downtown, and let's come up with the best possible plan for downtown and then apply lessons learned to the rest of the parish. We're not a city parish agency. We were a group of concerned citizens that were led by our Baton Rouge Area Foundation, and were given the tools to do that through the funding, through the civic leadership. And so we fashioned this plan just for downtown. It is a very smart growth plan that leverages the existing resources and, you know, builds on what's already there and just makes it a much more functioning and efficient plan for downtown.
It's interesting that you talk about your downtown plan as a smart growth plan, because when we think of smart growth, we normally think about the region or the suburbs. Tell me about the smart growth principles that are reflected in your downtown plan.
Well, I think, number one, it's very walkable. When the plan was developed, we figured out how do you link all of the existing cultural attractions? Where do you need to add them so that they would form a walkable downtown, but also then would attract people from outside? It's a gridded downtown, and so then why was downtown not connected to the neighborhoods surrounding it? We began to look at all of those features. And again, it was a time where the state of Louisiana had made a commitment to legislation that had been enacted years prior. And the legislation was fashioned that state workers needed to be moved into the downtown area. So the state began to build, I would say, we had six buildings under design when we did Plan Baton Rouge. And what the state agreed, instead of making them monoliths and turning their back on downtown, because of the excitement and the buy-in that we got from the community, the state decided to make each of those buildings pedestrian-friendly, friendly to the downtown, and it has really been an amazing example of good urbanism and actually building on the structure of downtown, but making it a much friendlier place.
I want to go back to the smart growth question you posed, because the experience with downtown then led Plan Baton Rouge to apply for a grant, which they received to do a smart growth audit or analysis of the entire parish, spurned by those lessons learned in downtown Baton Rouge. And that audit was complete, and now we are engaged in a parish-wide discussion of smart growth.
Does this discussion primarily center around how to handle transportation?
Yes, I would say so, but it's also about connecting neighborhoods. You know, when you build a new neighborhood in many communities throughout the United States, all of the cars are emptied onto your one main artery. And so that's been a very controversial issue that we've been promoting. It's also about, you know, what are the widths of the streets? Do they all need to be, you know, these huge subdivision, these huge arteries, or could they be nice little subdivision streets? We've also talked about making everything walkable and providing services. We have almost no mixed-use developments in Baton Rouge, in the parish of East Baton Rouge. So that's a whole new concept. Prior to Katrina, when we would talk about these mixed-use developments, we couldn't even get anybody to listen to us. Now, we have three either in design are being planned. So that's a pretty radical change that we've seen.
What was it about Katrina that forced the discussion or made the discussion more acceptable?
Well, I think it's all about the traffic. When you realize you're spending, you know, to spend 30 minutes in your car getting to work in the morning was pretty awful for East Baton Rouge Parish. And then it got to be 45 minutes. And then post-Katrina, it was an hour and a half. And we would laughingly say, Gwen and I both are good urbanists. We both live very close to downtown and more of the inner city. But even to go into the first ring suburb from downtown was a good 30-minute drive at noon. I mean, it totally changed the way we look at our lives.
And from a housing perspective, Carol, as Boo mentioned earlier, within the first 15, 20 days, every available piece of real estate was gone. So we were frantically setting up temporary housing and trailer villages, and then realizing that we now had new residents that needed more permanent housing that we were not prepared to present to them.
You said that there was a lot of resistance to this idea of connecting neighborhoods. Did the enormous increase in traffic help people begin to see connected neighborhoods, connected streets, through streets, as a way to solve the traffic problem, or was there something else at work?
No, it has not worked yet. It has not worked. That is one of the things that we have been promoting and pushing. It's the one thing that we find neighborhoods just pack the planning commission meetings to protest against. They do not want their neighborhoods connected. It's still our...
What are they afraid of?
Well, number one, there might be 12 more cars on their subdivision street, and we have very wide roads within our subdivision, so the traffic and the speed of the traffic is a problem. And we have gotten our Department of Public Works to change street design, which we feel was a huge victory or a huge step forward. We've gotten a lot of support from the city administration to do those sorts of things. But until our citizenry could see an example of a really well-designed, pedestrian-friendly neighborhood, like the ones of old, we cannot convince them that it would be smarter and more efficient to connect neighborhoods. The city of Lafayette, I do have to give them a pat on the back. It's a community just 60 miles from Baton Rouge. Their mayor is out stumping and telling the neighborhoods that if they want to do something about the traffic problem immediately, they need to start connecting their neighborhoods. Can you imagine?
Do you think it's simply counterintuitive to people that connected neighborhoods, connected streets means less congestion, that it has to mean that more traffic can come through my neighborhood and therefore I don't want it?
Exactly. And you know, I also think, you know, if you have one little area that has a lot of cars parking and it's around a convenience store, the convenience store probably wasn't planned properly, probably didn't have the required parking, and it's created a problem. So now they don't want anything like that to happen. So that's where you get to the mixed use problem. But we've really addressed that. I think that's the thing that we see a radical change is I attend a lot of the planning commission meetings and I don't see that sort of opposition anymore. I don't see the level of opposition that we used to see.
And it's because Plan Baton Rouge has effectively educated the planning commission members and developers are now starting to understand. I think when we have a few more successful examples on the ground, we can declare some success.
You said earlier Plan Baton Rouge and the work that citizens did on that plan prepared you for the Katrina aftermath and the influx of people you experienced. It seems to me that post-Katrina, every group in the country was eager to come down to the Gulf Coast and tell you what to do. I'm sure some of the advice was excellent, probably some was needed and wanted, and probably other pieces of advice or planning efforts were tolerated but not embraced. Having led a major planning effort in the city of Baton Rouge, what is your reaction to all of that advice that came your way in the way of the Mississippi Gulf Coast and New Orleans? How useful has that been to the area?
That is really a great question. I think the governor held a planning conference in New Orleans in November, and we had a huge participation by architects, engineers, the preservationists from across the nation, and landscape architects, and the types of advice and the presentations that they made were very helpful, and I think that it was a big step forward for the entire state because you had, I think, good participation in that. What we have seen so much in Baton Rouge, because both Gwen and I are fortunate to be a part of the Baton Rouge Area Foundation, we have had, it seems like, hundreds of national organizations, other nonprofits come to Baton Rouge and talk about how could they help, what could they do to assist us in some way. It's been hard to actually accept the help because things are so complicated. It's just hard for me to address the helpfulness of that. I think when it was organized and you went to a conference and you understood kind of big pictures and you had lots of input from the citizenry, that was a good thing. When you have other groups that come in one group at a time, it was exhausting, tell you the truth.
But because I think Boo's being a bit modest, Carol, because shortly after, the first 30 days were spent, of course, with us crisis managing. And in all different areas. But I can remember as early as the end of September, less than 30 days after the storm, there were discussions within Plan Baton Rouge and the Baton Rouge Area Foundation as to how we were going to manage the planning efforts statewide. How were we going to take advantage of what we had learned about comprehensive planning and have those lessons applied to this disastrous situation. And they've been working on this. And Boo, how many charrettes have you spearheaded?
We've had three thus far, and they have been extremely successful. And we now are embarking on the next phase of the planning where we're actually going to develop scenarios through our consultants, Calthorpe Associates and Calthorpe Fregonese, to look at how could Louisiana recover and grow and become, I think the byword is, stronger, smarter, and safer. And how do you apply all these planning principles based on smart growth, which I'm just so thankful that our governor has recognized the importance of that. And we are going to come up with a plan that shows if Louisiana would continue in the mode that it's in today, how will it grow and what will it look like and what will that require? What resources, how will the economics look? And then we're going to say, what would that look like in 25 years? And if you make some changes in the way we've been growing and do it, maybe very tight or not so tight, then what it look like? And we'll take that to the citizenry and let them respond and work on that. So I think we have a real opportunity to make our state, not just, you know, the city, a much better place for every citizen that lives here.
That's a really exciting approach you're taking to the work of rethinking and rebuilding Louisiana. Prior to Katrina, was there a competitive feeling between the citizens of New Orleans and the citizens of Baton Rouge?
Oh, yes. Yes, there always has been, because although Baton Rouge is the capital city, New Orleans is the city for Louisiana and for maybe the South, I would say. You know, it has such charm and culture and history, and it's just a magical place. We were just the capital city, and that is the way they looked at us. We think, you know, as a capital city and two major universities, we think we're a great city on the mighty Mississippi. But a lot of competition and a lot of jealousy between the two.
Does that still exist?
I would say that it does. And part of our challenge is to help New Orleans understand its importance to the overall plan, and that it is the intention of all of us to re-knit that culture, but re-knit it in a way that's beneficial to all of Louisiana and the rest of the country and nation, and the rest of the nation and world.
Gwen, what is the key to doing that? What message do the people of New Orleans need to hear that will make them feel confident that this process will work for them?
Boo talked about the first planning effort being the downtown and taking those lessons learned to another area. I came on board to work with an inner city area beautifully situated between downtown and a major university. Typical inner city anywhere in the country. What was so interesting about this two-year process is that, you know, you talk about smart growth, you talk about building, you talk about street design, but the overwhelming issue during the process were the cultural connections to that area. People want to know how their heritage will be preserved. How do you take that and then involve, if you will, redevelopment principles and smart growth principles so that you recreate the culture, but recreate the culture in a revitalized redevelopment area that thrives? I think New Orleans and the people of New Orleans are grappling with, how do I preserve my culture? And how does redevelopment impact the preservation of the culture? So I think the challenge that's in front of us is to answer that question.
Do you think there are any underlying principles that we can fall back on that help us do that? You are getting, I think, to an interesting and challenging place. Are there principles that you think guide action there?
In the plan that we work that we're working on in Baton Rouge, we gained a significant amount of confidence from the residents in the area by recognizing that fact. We hired, through our consultants, professors from Louisiana State University to actually go in and document the architectural history and the people history. So we bought some confidence because people saw that we were serious, and then they are involved in helping us figure out how do we preserve the old, if you will, and then make this a more vibrant city, community that will move into the future. So I think the recognition of the cultural, historic attributes of a place is where you gain your confidence. We had trouble with people, you know, well, we don't want to plan. We want to build something. We don't want to plan. We want to build something. Well, you can't build something without knowing what you're going to build and how it's going to connect to what will come, what will follow it.
And you know, there's an underlying theme through all of this. What happened in Plan Baton Rouge, what happened in Old South Baton Rouge Plan that Gwen was speaking of. And with what is going on in New Orleans right now and what we saw in the three different charrettes that we've done thus far, when you allow the people of the area to have a voice and a very strong one, and you listen and you demonstrate that you've listened, that's when you do great planning, because you take the wonderful ideas and the passion of the people from each area and you recognize that and you build on it. That's when you have great planning. I think the tragedy of what's happening in New Orleans right now is that they want so much for their voice to be heard, but until you get your immediate needs met, you really don't want to talk. I mean, you want to do something. And so the people of that whole New Orleans area don't know when the levees are going to be rebuilt. They don't know how they're going to be rebuilt. They don't know how they're going to handle the flooding. They don't know whether their insurance is going to cover anything. So people today, 7 months later, still haven't removed the sheetrock from their houses because they haven't heard from their insurance company. So the challenge right now, especially in the New Orleans area, is how can you get to these people who so desperately need to be heard and need to be part of the recovery process, and yet they still are dealing with their everyday needs. Now, this is not even to mention the 100,000 people that are still dispersed throughout the nation.
I appreciate very much the challenge you're dealing with in Baton Rouge and New Orleans. Boo Thomas, Gwen Hamilton, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
Boo Thomas is Executive Director of Plan Baton Rouge. Gwen Hamilton is Senior Director of Plan Baton Rouge and Director of Special Projects for the Baton Rouge Area Foundation. After a short break, we'll return to talk with Ken Dunn about his farms in the heart of Chicago, along with his efforts to encourage recycling and reuse in the city. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Ken Dunn is founder and director of Chicago's Resource Center, a nonprofit environmental education organization. The center is devoted to the economic and educational revitalization of city neighborhoods through recycling, urban gardening, and other programs that reclaim and reuse resources. Ken grew up on a farm in Kansas and moved to Chicago in the 60s to study philosophy at the University of Chicago. Ever since, he's been trying to turn the city into a place that recycles its waste, reuses its old machinery, composts its scraps, and creates an alternative economy that is, in Ken's eyes, both sustainable and just. Ken, you've been at this business of recycling and reuse for 30 years. Are we making progress?
Well, actually, on the recycling, we are. But if we remember, recycling is only one stage of become more responsible to the environment. And I think there are many other things we're just missing. So I couldn't say our civilization is making progress to becoming more sustainable.
What are we missing?
I think the idea, we have to grasp the endpoint that we need to become sustainable, and that means that we not have our quality of life at the expense of any future generation's possibility of having a quality of life. So the way we depend on hydrocarbons and the way we injure the planet here and there, and the way we politically cause estrangements and conflicts around the world, it's unsustainable. And we should be looking towards having less violence against our planet and less violence against other people.
All right. Huge topic. Mm-hmm. How does one individual get his or her arms around what he or she can do to contribute to a solution for the whole?
You know, I think that's how we got started on recycling, is the way towards sustainability and the environmental goal. It's something everybody could do, and I think it was intended as how we could learn the pleasures of doing things consistent with our long-term values. But I think it's been grabbed by commercial ventures, and it's almost sometimes it looks like what people can do so they don't feel responsible for all the other problems that they should be moving on to. So I think the goal is to find elements in your own life that are more satisfying to do responsibly that you can do, and that means your choices of transportation, your choices of work, the choices of spending time with your family, and many other things.
You said you seem to have a problem with the commercialization of recycling. What's going wrong there, in your opinion?
Well, I think if we were looking at it seriously, we wouldn't be criticizing any particular corporation, but we would be noticing that the whole direction of our modern economy does not take us in the direction of living at peace with our planet and with fellow human beings. And the main problem about recycling having become a dominant success is that it's part of overconsumption. Part of recycling would be realizing we could choose better in our forms of consumption. And let me tell you an anecdote where I learned this 30 years ago. Some person was bringing in large quantities of newspaper to a recycling site and making small talk. I said, wow, you must not have been here for a month or more. And she said, oh no, since we can recycle, we buy two copies of the New York Times. We know the pleasure of being the first one to get through it, right?
Right. Taking the third one off the stack so you don't get the one that's been handled by other people.
Yeah. So I think we have to get beyond little symbols of making progress to find out what real progress is. And recycling is just a symbol of making progress.
Tell me about the range of activities you engage in at the Resource Center.
Well, I Actually, as I was in graduate school here, I decided there should be an institution focused on learning how to be a sustainable society and how a city could become sustainable. So we tried to identify a number of the areas where we could move in that direction. Of course, recycling is one of them, composting, urban agriculture, developing a food system that's local and doesn't process and ship and packaged foods. We also have a couple bike shops and a couple other programs, but mostly our programs are focusing on trying to, at the pilot stage, prove that a system works, like bike transportation works in the city, as does urban agriculture, and that it's more satisfying to be part of local sustainable systems than the dominant economy suggests we use.
Tell me specifically, Ken, about the scope of your urban farming.
For the last 30 years, we've actually been investigating and discovering what would be appropriate. And we figured out the system that is appropriate for the 10,000 vacant acres in the city. Much of it is held in speculation for later development. So we can't expect all 10,000 acres to be permanently in agriculture. But it happens that most of this 10,000 acres will be vacant 5 to 15 years. And over the 30 years I've been watching vacant space, there has been between 7 and 10,000 acres vacant. They just move around as development moves around. So we've developed a movable farm where we don't use soil that's there, in fact seal whatever soil is there because of potential contamination, grow only in compost, and that is very easily moved to the next site when development occurs on the site we're occupying. For instance, the site that most people are aware of where we farm now at Division and Clybourne was, until 2 years ago, across the alley where a building is going up. And the 7 years before that, it was at a site on the south side. So the fence, the tool shed and office building and compost are all just picked up and moved, and it can be done in a couple of days. So our notion is that urban agriculture can be a large step towards reconnecting with our environment. Our food system is not serving the health of most peoples, and we find that growing organically and processing less is more healthy. And the other thing that I think it connects to is very few people deal with real facts or reality. We mostly deal with symbols and images, and being connected or grounded is not all that common in Chicago. And everyone through toddlers, through school children, adults, and seniors get a great pleasure of being connected to something real. I'm thinking of something that where value is produced, that you can put seeds in the soil and you get something of value that you can use. And I think that would be good experience for everybody. And we can get to a new sense of grounding and a new sense of values in our society.
Let me ask you a couple of practical questions about the farms you run. Who does the work? Who tends those farms?
We like to think of the work to be available to the local population. We have actually the staff at the garden usually is recent graduates who could have chosen any job but chose to do something grounded and something that maybe will make a difference in the way our city is becoming more sustainable and people more healthy. So we have a highly motivated college workforce that pairs with local people who are needing work. And we find this work is a great entry back into the workforce for many people that have been battling abuse problems or are homeless. It really is connected with something real, and they identify with that. So it's very appropriate developing jobs in low-income communities where people have been out of work for some time.
And what can you pay in a job on an urban garden?
We pay $7 or $8 an hour. Part of what our farm does is we grow food locally thinking that that's a good step to make sure people throughout the city eat well. But to sell in the community where many of the farms are, you can't charge premium rates as one expects for organic foods. And if you can't charge premium rates, you can't pay a living wage. So the compromise we've developed is that half of the product is sold to high-end restaurants at very dear prices, and they really do appreciate the freshness and the quality of the product. The other half is sold at a farm stand right at the farm at supermarket prices. So there's no debate over, you know, I expect to go to a farm and get it for cheaper than I would pay for a supermarket. So you don't even bring up the discussion of why it's more, costs more. So we can pay living wage to individuals who live locally by selling dearly to restaurants who will pay more. Mm-hmm. So my notion of urban agriculture as maybe a better symbol of us moving in the right direction than recycling is that it touches us on so many levels. It greatly expands the jobs available. The 10,000 acres in the city has a possibility of 40,000 jobs. And jobs that are really desired by the people that are needing jobs, everybody loves working outdoors. And you love seeing the results of your labor, that it's there when you've produced a good tomato and you can taste it and you can take it home and share it with your friends. So I think urban agriculture is a very good entry to becoming a more sustainable city and a city that is more equitable in terms of nutrition. One could try to figure out how to get whole food stores in every community in the city. Well, that's hard in the present economy. But in fact, one can get production growing in every neighborhood in the city, and everybody loves touring a garden and choosing produce to take home.
You said that part of your strategy is proof of concept. In other words, you'll take a concept, prove it under the Resource Center, and then I would assume hope that it will be replicated by others. Have you seen, I mean, do others come to study what you've done at the Resource Center and try to duplicate that in other cities and other parts of this city? Do you feel like you're having that sort of leveraged impact?
We do have a lot of conversations, and besides others learning from me, I learn from others, of course. But the city of Chicago is in a major greening orientation. The mayor has met with us and has decided that he likes our idea of greening the entire city. Some lots maybe for beautification, but a lot of lots for food production. And as we were meeting last July, I said, I think we should take as the goal between you and I to not stop until every inch of this city is green, either for beautification or for food production. And he only said, can we include rooftops? And of course, we'll do that. And I think he feels, as I do, that Chicago will be more sustainable. The quality of life, the nutrition of the city will be much improved if we have green rather than barren, despoiled, vacant lots. Our system that I've been working on the last 30 years involves how do you clean up, seal possible contaminants, and grow nutritious food there. And that's one of the biggest resources the city has, is this vacant space where the rain and sun falls, and it can be very productive.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Ken Dunn. He is founder and director of the Resource Center. Ken, a past guest on our show said that the people of Hong Kong raise a majority of the greens that they consume within the very crowded confines of that city. Is it possible to do that in a city like Chicago?
Yes, but it'll take a lot of altering of consumption habits and how we use our space. We grow year-round, but without having a heated greenhouse, it's very limited what you can produce. You have to have a cold, hardy plant because our plastic protectors will allow it to grow in the winter, but it has to survive freezing cold when the sun doesn't shine for a couple of days. And the other thing we notice The mosh that we do grow, we harvest once a week in the spring and fall when it's the ideal growing temperature and plenty of sun. Throughout the winter, we can harvest once a month. So food production is really down when the sun is down, and the quantity of sun available is really down. So there'll have to be a lot of adjustments for preserving foods, drying and preserving for the winter, using tubers and squashes, and this is a pretty big change from our modern eating habits. We consider everything on our palate any season. And one of the things many top chefs are talking about is eating in season and also eating in place. Eating in the season where what you eat, what is produced, where you live, and when it is produced. And there is another pleasure of living, of anticipating the strawberries in the spring. And it is possible for our city to produce all that is consumed here, but it'll mean a big rearranging of our city.
You mentioned in passing the impact urban farming has on transportation and packaging of food. As gas prices continue to rise, do you expect us to become more focused on growing food close to home so that that transportation cost is eliminated?
Well, you know, the cost is so minimal to us. It is a cost more to the environment than to us individually. We can ship things in quantity and process them in quantity, so it's a very minor expense. And I don't think anybody is thinking of going to less processed and local foods because of the expense. I can remember participating in the group in the early 70s that was recommending what would be the changes needed in our city for the year 2000. Included in that study was that we would have to grow more of our own food because transportation would be getting more expensive as petroleum became more scarce. But we haven't seen any of that. Probably the transportation expense of food is no more than it was 30 or more years ago because it's just become quite efficient. So I think we have to start thinking locally, not because of monetary cost to ourselves, but our footprint on the planet.
Are there cities that you think are doing a particularly good job when it comes to sustainability?
You know, I haven't studied that much, although I do think out on the West Coast, Seattle and Portland, I hear many good programs from them. I mentioned Mayor Daley's commitment to greening our city, which I think we're all proud of. It's kind of not like a politician to choose a long road to a goal. You like to get something that'll give you headlines next month. But that's the way the city is going. We're developing facilities to compost 2,000 tons per day, and that will provide the rich nutrients to grow food here. So we'll have a local complete system. And before any headline is grabbed by anybody, we'll have done a lot of work putting the infrastructure in place to become a self-sufficient, sustainable food city.
That's fascinating. Ken, if you could will a civic response to the issues you're dealing with, recycling, reuse, urban farming, what would that civic response be?
Well, I think it would be willingness to look at things we're not familiar with and experience them to see if they have the qualities of the eating experience that we're experiencing. And eating organic food in place and in the time it was produced. And I think the reason why many people don't consider alternatives other than what they've habitually engaged in is that we're somewhat afraid that if we differ too much from the way our society has been moving, that things will crumble. We heard recently, if we don't buy cars now, our economy's going down. Wrong approach. We have to find ways that keep our economy active without perpetuating systems that have passed their time. Anybody that looks rationally recognizes the time of the automobile is past. So I think we need to realize that all of the high quality of life that have been possible with our modern conveniences, transportation, universities, and cultural institutions, it's all possible plus more if we really connect and have a total transformation of our values. Instead of dealing with symbols, deal with realities, a carrot fresh from the ground, a tomato warm from the vine. These pleasures, when added with culture and music, can make a very pleasurable life, and the SUV is not essential.
You've talked about recycling. Periodically, can we hear stories of a municipality's recycling ending up in a landfill? Mm-hmm. Such a story, I think, surfaced in Chicago a few weeks ago. There was one in Memphis. How confident can citizens be in their city's recycling programs?
Well, this is like many things. You have to really know your program and who does it. Most municipalities will have program you can trust, but the city is just changing its program. The city of Chicago is changing its program because it finds that about 10% truly gets recycled, and that's over its long period. And so it's going for separate collection, which people can trust.
What do you have any rule of thumb for a good participation rate in a community? I mean, if a city has a good thriving recycling program, what would that look like, and what would the participation rate be?
70-80% of the population will respond to a quality recycling program. And what we've experienced over the years, if you know your community and craft a program appropriate to it, all communities will recycle, that every human being does care about the future of our planet and want to lessen their footprint, but they want a program that fits their community. And I might give as an example, we've operated a buyback recycling program. Currently, it's the program that is under contract with the CHA and the
buyback, Chicago Housing Authority.
Chicago Housing Authority. And the concept there is that you provide a motivation that is relevant to the community you're dealing with. And our motivation for Chicago Housing Authority residents is twofold. One, that we hire individuals from the buildings that do participate, and that each person that brings down materials to be recycled receives their value, which is the buyback. They pay for their containers while they're shopping. Their containers are bought back from them when they are recycling. And this way, we get very high participation. And I think that's probably the other extreme from the lakefront community that's very environmentally aware and will recycle quite willingly. Even people who are in public housing find this program relevant to their values. They want to provide jobs for their neighbors and a little more income for their household.
Ken, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Ken Dunn is founder and director of Chicago's Resource Center. You're listening to Smart City. City Views commentator Walker Smith shares his very personal views of life today in cities.
There is an old-growth forest in Atlanta within running distance of my house. 60 acres bordered by two of the busiest streets in town, this forest buffers the South Fork of Peachtree Creek, a major tributary of the Chattahoochee River. Trees that are 100 years old and older form the canopy. Water oak, red oak, white oak, river birch, willow, red maple, yellow poplar, and loblolly pine trees grow there. It is home to eastern box turtles and great horned owls. Its size and connection to additional habitat via the creek make it a self-sustainable ecosystem as well as a key part of the city's biological corridor. In 1998, a developer was petitioning for rezoning to build a high-density residential area on half of the acreage. This brought the forest to the attention of many local residents for the first time, galvanizing people into action. The Wildwood Urban Forest Group was formed to oppose development. Trees Atlanta and the Nature Conservancy began looking into alternatives. Local neighborhood associations voted against the developer's proposals. And the city of Atlanta eventually stopped it, largely on the basis of a 1997 study warning against further development that would increase storm runoff into the already overtaxed city floodplain. In 2001, the city used impact fees collected from developers to create the Wildwood Urban Forest Preserve. In 2004, the Family Foundation of Home Depot founder Arthur Blank donated funds to connect a new Greenway Trail to this forest. This success is encouraging, but more is needed. In 1974, 44% of the land area in Atlanta had less than 20% tree cover. In 1996, it was 70.8%. Atlanta as a whole has lost 65% of its forest canopy since 1972, causing a 9-degree rise in average local temperatures. The shade from the remaining forest saves $2.8 million in energy cost each year. It also removes 1,196 metric tons of air pollution, yielding an annual savings of $6.5 million. The forest lost from 1974 to 1996 would have removed 11 million more pounds of pollutants at a value of $28 million per year. The storm water retention capacity of the Atlanta urban forest is worth $85.9 million a year. Tree loss in Atlanta from 1974 to 1996 increased storm water runoff by 33%, which would cost over $1 billion in new infrastructure to replace. Studies elsewhere have shown that trees add 5 to 15% to residential property values and that visitors spend more time and money in business districts filled with trees. Yet Metro Atlanta continues to lose over 50 acres of tree cover each day to development. Atlanta is not alone. The loss of urban forest is a major threat to every city. Indeed, it is a peril that should make preservationists of us all if we want to sustain the quality and affordability of the urban lifestyles we now enjoy. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com, where you can find archived shows, sign up for our podcast, and register for our weekly newsletter. Our theme music was composed and performed by Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage, with additional music by Chris Reyes. Eric Rudd edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.